How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? My name is
AudioToYou.com, the home of quality podcasts.
It's like he was with me inside my head.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 129 of Sign Language. Got another couple of emails from Jim Addy. This one starts, Bruce, I just finished reading and posting to the GearSluts.com forum about this. Thought it might be a good thing to share with your listeners. To set the stage, there's a lot of discussion about the current trend of mastering music loudly, using tools such as compression and peak limiting, whether or not it's a good idea, and how to stop the loudness war. You've covered it here too. Stimulated by the 12 pages of posts there, I hammered out this, my latest anti-insomnia treatment I know you'll call Loudness, War, and Peace. First, the loudness war is more than a bit dumb. It's a war without a victor, one where there is only damage and destruction. In radio, when two stations have a loudness war, it's been going on in the US for nearly half a century, it's because they're both broadcasting the same or very similar content. The music is identical, the presentation similar enough to be identical. The war is driven by station executives suffering an ego blow when they punch their station's button on their car radio, and it's not as loud as the competition. In broadcasting, there is a real, genuine fight for listeners, ratings, and dollars. But the assumption is, a listener will stay with the louder station. It's really a fallacy because the next thing a listener touches after the station selection is the volume control, which he sets to preference. Beyond sustaining modulation levels over the noise floor, loudness processing in radio has no point. But a radio station has an enemy to fight, the other station, and territory to win, listeners. So the war, be it ever so misguided, rages on. In the recorded music loudness war, there are no enemies, no such territory to fight over. There's no competition, because if you like an artist's music, you'll buy the CD or the download. There's no identical but competing CD or download that's so similar as drives the choice by some means other than content. The very second a listener hears the music, it gets adjusted to whatever volume he needs and wants. Louder is only a bit more annoying than softer. Those that master loud are not making friends of any listeners. There is great wisdom in establishing a loudness standard, but it should be based on a highly reliable and repeatable measure of loudness, for which Bobcat's K system is a start in the right direction. In any loudness war, there are really only losers. The listeners lose because they don't get clean, undistorted music. What they get is overprocessed and distorted. The record companies, producers, artists lose because they are mangling permanently what will become an indelible record of their art for all time. Record companies don't sell more music because it's mastered loud. They sell music because of what it is. By the time it's heard in all its loudly mastered glory, the music has already been purchased and the listener has turned his volume control down. See what I mean? No territory to fight over and no competition to fight with. How can you have a war under those conditions? The one thing that would put an immediate end to the war is if listeners who purchased overprocessed music returned it and demanded their money back. Money talks, and returns speak very, very loudly. iTunes will grant a refund for a poor quality release. So will Amazon, and any physical store. All a buyer has to do is complain, very firmly and specifically, about the quality. But it's not likely to happen, because as I said before, the entire market is content driven. If consumers like the specific music and want to own it, they will, for the most part, put up with a large palette of audio degradation. You can't go and buy the clean version of the same song done by the other fill-in group name. There isn't one. LN, as described here, And I'm just going to jump in and say I'm not sure what Jim's referring to. Obviously something else in the Gear Sluts forum to which he was posting, so I'm not sure what LN is. As described here, is probably not the solution, but rather a band-aid, and not a great one at that. On iTunes sound check, no, it's not a good solution. But there are others that are. Audacy Dynamic Volume, for example, takes action based on research where real listeners were given a volume control knob to adjust when exposed to different material at different levels. Their actions were recorded, and human loudness response was characterized. The result is first, a loudness adjustment that mimics what you would do anyway. Second, the system can look ahead to anticipate. Third, and this is the biggie, it is based on hearing perception at a specific SPL in the listener's environment. Audacy Dynamic Volume is not a compressor, but it works, works well, is without artifact, and blows the doors off night mode, quote unquote. If ADV would become available in enough devices, even if the loudness war ended tomorrow, legacy material would be handled well. It is propagating, but hasn't found its way to iTunes yet. It is available in many AV receivers. Last comment directed at those who master loud. If your material is destined to ever be played on radio, please realize what radio stations do to your stuff. More compression, multiband no less, peak limiting, and even deliberate clipping. Their distortion adds to what you did in mastering, and in some cases multiplies it. And nothing is ever any louder on the air because of it, only more distorted, crushed, and disfigured. Thanks for letting me vent. Sorry, I can't vote in the poll. I don't see a clear right choice. Jim Addy, Moving Bits Productions and Platinum Home Theatres. Footnote, sharp-eared listeners will recognise Audacy as the company that brings us Malt-EQ room equalisation. For those wishing to take advantage of Audacy's room calibration tools, you can get it as a DAW plugin from IK Multimedia. And Jim's given me the link, so I'll put that in the show notes. The plugin doesn't include dynamic volume as discussed above, but does come with a calibrated microphone, necessary for setup. Calibrating your monitoring environment is the first step toward better mixing. Well, Jim, thank you very much for that email. There's a couple of things I want to throw in there, though. Towards the end there, you addressed the mastering engineers themselves. And although I didn't partake in the discussion, I did see on the ProSound web forums where this same discussion was taking place, the same sort of thing happening, you know, where you know, audiophiles like yourself were saying, you know, all it needs is, you know, mastering engineers to realize the futility of this and, you know, everything would be better. And not one, but multiple mastering engineers who, you know, who do it for a living day to day, like not just, you know, guys who thrash out a master, you know, once a month in their bedrooms, but actual, you know, full-time, fully employed working mastering engineers, all chimed in and said, you've got to understand that at the end of the day, it's the record company, the A&R guy, the producer and the artist who are our bread and butter as mastering engineers. And if this is what they want, it's what we have to give them if we want to remain employed. So it's kind of a catch-22. You know, you've got mastering engineers out there who understand why the loudness war is a bad idea, but who feel trapped by the circumstances, you know, because there have been cases, according to, you know, threads that I've read on ProSound Web, where mastering engineers have done, you know, the very best to their ability at mastering an album, and then the client, and I use client in inverted commas, it might have been the artist, might have been the producer, might have been the record company, has come back and gone, sounds awesome, but it's not loud enough. And those mastering engineers have gone, well, I'm not prepared to push it any further because we're going to distort it. And so the client says, okay, no worries, give us your invoice. And they just go off to another mastering engineer who is prepared to crush it further. So, you know, all the while that kind of thing is happening, nothing's going to improve. And on top of that, this is my other point, is we're growing up, we've already grown up, but there is an entire generation of kids who are growing up with music that's only ever been crushed. And they've never heard music with dynamics. And particularly with the, you know, the mobile audio landscape as it is now, you know, where, you know, probably 3 out of every 4 people you see walking down the street's got a pair of earbuds in. You know, we're all listening to, well, not only music, but podcasts and, you know, radio and, you know, all sorts of streaming media as we're going about our daily business. And not everyone has noise isolating or noise suppressing earbuds, right? So we've grown into this civilization that wants to consume media on the go all the time, you know, whether that be music or podcast or whatever. And we need to compete with the noise of industry, society, pedestrians, traffic, and everything else that's going on in the world around us while we're trying to consume our media on the go. And so this overreaction to mastering, I hate to say it, but lends itself to that environment, you know, where if you crush stuff that little bit more, it makes it easier to consume in a mobile environment, you know, because you, I can't believe I'm saying this, but you don't want to be walking down the street with music that has too much dynamic range, because the softer parts, you know, you're not going to hear them over all the noise and kerfuffle that's going on around you as you're walking down the street or riding your push bike to work, as the case may be. So it's a tough one, you know. To go back to my first point, I also think that that is a major stumbling block to us getting over the loudness war. You know, all the while you have mastering engineers who fear that they will not get any work if they don't master loud, then the situation is just going to propagate. You know, it's never going to get better. In my utopian ideal, we would see all the mastering engineers of the world get together and say, let's just set the bar right here, right now, and none of us, you know, we all have to agree that none of us will flex on this, you know? I won't claim to fully understand how Bob Katz's K system works. I've started reading it. I'm reading Bob's book, Mastering Audio, The Art and the Science. Sorry, I don't have it in front of me. It's in my studio at work. You know, and I'm halfway through it, and I have read the bit on the K. Actually, have I? Actually, no. You know what? I don't even think I've got to that part of the book. But I think at one point I actually flicked forward to that point and, you know, tried to get my head around it, and I probably need to reread it. Although I don't completely understand it, I do understand the concept of it, and I think it's a very noble, you know, idea. If only we could get the entire world to adopt it. You know, that's the problem. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. So yeah, so I don't know what the answer is, Jim. I agree that the loudness war is just ridiculous, and I do agree that there are no winners. You know, we just ending up with a society that doesn't know what good music mastering should sound like. Anyway, Jim then sent me another email. This one is thankfully a shorter one. Bruce, just found this. If you're a Mac user, which I'm not, here's a free LEQ, just pronounce it L-E-Q, measurement tool called Audio Leak. I've been using it to look at LEQ for music recorded from different eras. And wow, does it ever show the loudness war in action. For example, a song recorded in the late 60s came up nearly 12 dB lower than one recorded in this decade. Using it is simple. You just drag and drop a file on the interface, and a few seconds later you have LEQ data on the entire thing, with a chart of peak levels and LEQ weighted and unweighted graphed against time. Try a few of your favourites and see what's been done to peaks and averages. Here's a bit from the user guide. What is Audio Leak? An audiophile LEQ analyzer. LEQ, long-term equivalent level, is the averaged RMS loudness level for a recording. LEQ equals 10 times log 10, the sum of the squared sample amplitudes, divided by n, where n is the number of samples. Okay, I'm officially lost already. LEQ does not indicate the dynamic range of the recording, the difference between the loudest and quietest sounds, but this can be gleaned from the difference between the RMS and peak level as shown by Audio Leak. I'm just going to jump in there and say, no, I disagree with that. The difference between the RMS and the peak is simply the crest. It's not the dynamic range, because the dynamic range is the difference between the softest part and the loudest part, not the difference between the average and the loudest part. So I'm not sure I agree with them there. Anyway, moving on. LEQ has come into widespread use in the motion picture, theatre and broadcast, radio and television, industries. It's used to ensure that different program materials are played back at perceptibly equivalent loudness levels. An example is equalising the playback loudness of movie trailers and the feature film in the theatre. Another example, that isn't always followed in practice, is ensuring that commercials are broadcast at the same perceived volume as other program material. What does this mean to you, the audio slash music enthusiast? One use for this software is to quickly analyze music recordings to determine relative loudness levels without having to listen to them. A DJ might use it to preview relative playback levels. A very popular use for Audio Leak is equalizing the loudness levels of podcasts. Here's a link to a technical document on the subject of loudness, and I will put a copy of that link in the show notes. Again, Jim Addy, Moving Bits Productions and Platinum Home Theatres. Thank you very much, Jim. I do take issue with that definition that they've got in there. Yeah, anyway, keen to hear your thoughts on that, Jim. Anyway, I got another email from Jeff Hankerson, who I haven't heard from in ages, so thanks for the email, Jeff. He said, at the Home Theatre Geeks podcast, this episode features Alan Kramer, Executive Vice President and CTO of SRS Labs, Inc. They dive deep into the perception of sound, and Alan Kramer describes how they attempt to provide an audio experience closer to a live stage than stereo or 5.1 surround. I thought you and sign language listeners might enjoy it. I'll also say I purchased SRS WOW for iTunes and really find the product adds depth to the sound. Just my opinion, of course. That and a dollar or five will buy you a cup of coffee. Jeff Hankerson. Thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that. And I'll put the link to that episode. I downloaded it and had a listen. It was a good listen in the show notes. And finally, an email from Ron Eastwood, who said, hey, Bruce, audio forensics may be opening a new chapter in an old case. The Ohio National Guard firing on rioting students on May the 4th, 1970. Here's a link to the article. I listened to the audio myself, and I don't hear the comments they hear, but I didn't crank it up too loud, and I was listening on computer speakers. It seems like our new audio tools can do a lot more than they ever dreamed of back in 1974 when they first analysed this. Ron Eastwood, Medina, Ohio. Well, thank you for the link, Ron, and I will put that in the show notes. I had a quick look at the link itself. It's essentially talking about this incident which occurred, you know, 40 years ago now. In fact, wow, it's like 40 years and a week ago, where, yeah, these rioting students were fired upon by the Ohio National Guard, and, yeah, they've reanalyzed the audio tapes using, you know, today's technology. And they've got a sample on the website that you can listen to, and it tells you, in a rather strange bit of web development, they've given you the times from the beginning of the audio file at which point you can hear certain things being said, like this happens at 9 seconds, this happens at 19 seconds, and so on. But the play counter on the embedded audio player in the web page actually counts down from the full running time of the clip towards zero, so you can't even rely on the counter for you know, working out how many seconds you are into the audio. But anyway, go and have a look at the link and read the story if you're not familiar with it, and yeah, keen to hear your thoughts. Ron, I tend to agree. I had a listen to it. I didn't crank it super loud, but I was listening on something better than computer speakers. I was listening on my Genelex here in my home studio. And, yeah, I think they're clutching at straws a little bit. It's not like it's super clear that, you know, what they say is being said was actually being said. You could certainly assume that that was what was being said, but I think that's all it would be. Just an assumption. So, yeah, it'd be interesting. I will confess I didn't read the entire text of the article because it was a bit too long. But, yeah. One other thing that occurred during the week... Well, we've had some fun and games at work over the last couple of weeks. Our chief engineer, Barry, has got some speakers in for us to potentially replace our studio monitoring. And I won't name the monitoring that we're using in our production studios at work, but they're not brilliant. They're okay, but they're not brilliant. They're pretty old technology. You know, they're just a standard speaker in a wooden box, and I think they're probably a 6-inch driver and a, you know, 1.5-inch tweeter. But like I said, they're fairly old and sound pretty dated, and they're just... they're just not set up right. And I mean, to be honest, the control room that I mix in at work is not particularly well designed in terms of where the speakers are placed in the room. So anyway, Barry got these two sets of speakers in for us, a pair of JBLs and a pair of Tannoys. Now, I'm a bit of a fan of Tannoys. Long-term listeners to this podcast would remember that before I got my Genelex, I was using Tannoy Reveals, the passive variety. And, you know, the Tannoys are a great speaker. And in fact, my Tannoy Reveals are now serving front, left and right duties in my lounge room, in my home theatre system. So I was very, you know, predisposed toward the Tannoys. And the JBLs, I will confess that the last time I had JBL monitoring was probably 20 years ago, or a little bit less. Oh, when was it? 90, 91. Yeah, so it was 20 years ago that I had JBL monitoring in a studio, and I was not particularly blown away by them. You know, at the time, JBL had the nickname Junk But Loud, which is still leveled at them occasionally. And in my opinion, those particular monitors were, you know, good cause for that nickname to be thrown JBL's way. They could certainly produce some volume, but I didn't think they were a brilliant speaker. They were okay, but they weren't brilliant. So when Barry said he was getting these JBLs in, I was like, okay, yeah, not fond of JBLs, but I'll give them a listen. And he said, you don't like JBL? And I went, no, not really. You know, and I told him the story and he said, oh, mate, he said, that's 20 years ago. He said, they've come a long, long way since then. And I said, okay, fair enough. I said, look, I'm, you know, I like to think of myself as being fairly open-minded, so I will give them an honest, unbiased listen, you know, and assume that they have improved their game in the 20 years since, which is not an unreasonable expectation. I mean, that's a lot of water under the bridge. So anyway, the thing about the JBLs is they came with a reference microphone and some software, and the speakers, you're going to love this, have USB ports in them and network ports in them. And so what happens is that you run a network cable between the two speakers and you plug the reference microphone into a laptop and you then run a USB cable from one of the speakers back to the laptop as well. And what happens is you run this calibration software on the laptop. It sends commands to the speakers. And what you do with the reference microphone, by the way, is should be fairly obvious, is you set it up at the mixing position, you know, where you are going to sit when you mix. And what the software does is it sends commands to the speakers. The speakers then generate a series of test tones, and those test tones are picked up by the reference mic at your mixing position, and the microphone signal is fed back to the laptop, which then analyzes the frequency response of what was heard at the mixing position. And it then calibrates the speakers through some, you know, frequency adjustment so that they are essentially giving you a flat response. So basically what it does is tune the speakers to the room that you're in, which is pretty mad technology if you ask me. You know, I guess I'm not the kind of guy who goes out and buys new monitoring every day, so I'm guessing this is probably not brand new technology. It's probably been around for a little while, but it's the first time I'd encountered it, and I thought, man, that is just so awesome. And the thing that really spun me out, right, was when Barry brought the speakers in, he said, oh, let's plug them in. I went, okay, fair enough. So we've taken down the speakers that I normally have to mix on. He's put the JBLs up and we've started to give him a bit of a listen, and we're listening to different styles of music, and, you know, we're listening to voice tracks and, you know, different volumes and whatnot. And I said, yeah, you know, I mean, they're head and shoulders above what I've been working with. I said, but to my ear, they sound a little bit boxy, you know, that sort of low mid-range sort of 500 600 hertz range sounds just a little bit too boxy to my ear. And he said, oh, okay, fair enough. Do you want to have a listen to the tannoys? I said, yeah, all right. You know, so we'd had the JBLs up for quarter hour, 20 minutes, I suppose. So we've taken the JBLs down and put the tannoys up, and I was like, oh yeah, that's what I've come to love from tannoys. You know, they just sound fantastic. And so anyway, played with those for a little while, and anyway, then I must have gone off to lunch or something, and I think it was the end of the day, and Barry said to me, look, you know, you go, I'll catch you tomorrow, he said, but I'm going to put the JBLs back up and I'm going to run the calibration software. And I went, okay, sweet, sounds good, you know, look forward to hearing them, you know, after the calibration, to see if it makes a difference. So I've come back in the next morning and Barry's come down and he's gone, have another listen to the JBLs. Put some music on and just went, oh my God. It was like completely different speaker or pair of speakers. They sounded awesome. And I said, wow, that is just phenomenal. You know, that boxiness is gone and they just sound rich. The bottom end is there. It's in your face. But, you know, the mids and the highs are great. They're just fantastic, you know. And he said, yeah, cool. And he said, And this is the funny thing. Barry was predisposed to the JBLs, and I was predisposed to the Tannoys. And he said to me, "But I think the Tannoys sound better." And I said, "You really?" And he's like, "Yeah, I think they do." He said, "I think the top end on them is better." So, long story short, I mixed on the JBLs for about a week, I guess. And then round about Wednesday of this week, I think, he came back down to me and he said, "You had enough of those JBLs, we can put the Tannoys back up." And I said, "Yeah, sure, you know." And so he put the Tannoys back up. And you got to understand that when you listen to monitors like this, you know, when you're trying to analyze the difference between them and you don't have them set up simultaneously with an AB switch, you know, you've got that couple of minutes between pulling one set down and putting the other set up and putting, you know, plugging them in, and, you know, and you're kind of, you know, it's not that you forget, but you don't remember instinctively the exact frequency response that you were getting out of the set that you just pulled down when you start listening to the next set. But something happens when you mix on a set of speakers for a week. You know, within that week, you really do become familiar with the speaker and what it does and how it reacts to different program sources and different volumes. And so anyway, he's come along and he's taken the JBLs down and he's put the Tannoys back up. Now, the Tannoys don't have the calibration software, although actually that's a funny thing. I've got to mention it to him because I was reading in the manual for the Tannoys that they supposedly do come with calibration software. So I have to search that out. But whether they do or don't, I don't know. But we haven't run any calibration software on them. So he's taken the JBLs down. He's put the Tannoys back up. And this is after I've spent a week mixing with these JBLs. And started playing some music through the Tannoys. And I went, "Oh, yeah, now I hear what you mean about the top end of the Tannoys is just that it's more open. It just seems to have more depth in the top end of the speakers." So, yeah, so it's been a lot of fun listening to these couple of pairs of speakers. And at the moment, the Tannoys are still up in my studio and one of the other engineers in the building has got the JBLs now. So, yeah, so hopefully we're going to get some new monitoring in the studio in the next couple of months, which will be lovely. But at the same time, the distributor who gave us the speakers has also thrown us a couple of Shure ribbon microphones. And they said, "Look, you know, have a play with these. Tell us what you think. We'd really love you guys to write a review for us." So, not sure how I feel about writing a review. I don't know how that review is going to be used. But anyway, so I plugged one of these ribbon mics in, and our input chain is via a Yamaha O2R digital console. And I was a little skeptical, you know, because I've got my AEA R84 ribbon mic, I know how much gain ribbons need, you know, to get working. And so I was a little bit skeptical as to whether or not the mic preamps on the O2R were going to be up to the task. And sure enough, I plugged in one of these Shure ribbon mics and I've absolutely had to crank the mic gain to the roof to get enough level for what was admittedly a sort of softer spoken female. If it was one of the guys that we use sometimes who, you know, really project hard, the mic pre's on the Yamaha probably would have been good enough. But for this particular female, it had absolutely cranked, and I was getting peaks of probably minus 20, minus 24 dB full scale, which is a long way down even for me. You know, I mean, I usually track it around, you know, minus 12, you know, minus 18, but minus 24, that's quite a way down. So anyway, I went back to Barry and I said, "Look, you know, these guys want us to write reviews on these mics. And to be honest, we don't have mic preamps here that are designed for the task of driving, you know, ribbon mics. You know, ribbons need some grunt." And he said, "Fair enough, I'll get in touch with them. We'll see what they can come up with." So anyway, a day later, he comes back into my room and he goes, "Hey, I got you a couple of more toys." And I went, "Oh, okay." Okay, what do you got? Throws me a Neve 1073 mic pre, which is a two-channel mic pre with digital out. Not that we're using the digital out, we're just going out of the analog outputs and into the O2R. And another one called Peach Audio, which apparently is like a $5,500 mic preamp. Again, two-channel mic pre. Yeah, so I got to have a play with those two, and I tried the Neve first, and it sounded absolutely gorgeous. And then I plugged in the Peach, and it sounded great. Like, it certainly ate the Yamaha mic pre's for breakfast, but it was kind of like doing Universal Studios after you've done Disneyland, you know what I mean? It was just not quite in the same ballpark. And so I listened to the Peach preamp for about 2 minutes and went, nah, this is just not quite cutting it the way the Neve does. So yeah, so I'm now using the Neve mic pre with these two ribbons. And I don't know the serial numbers of these two ribbons, or I'd tell you, but I'll have to find that out so I can, you know, I won't get it in the show notes because I've got to publish this podcast tomorrow, but when I find out, I'll mention it on the next podcast. So yeah, so we've had a bit of fun at work over the last couple of weeks, trying out some speakers and microphones and things. Anyway, that will pretty much do it for this episode. If you've got anything you would like to share or question me on, or anything you want to know that we haven't covered as yet, please drop me an email, studio@audiotou.com. And until I speak with you next, take care.
This has been another audiotou.com podcast. For previous episodes, check out signlanguagepodcast.com. Please send questions, comments, or feedback to studio@audiotou.com.